I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All of television history is contained within the Box of Delights.
It was happening in front of us.
Incredible.
In our living rooms. It was amazing.
Guests pick their favourite television moment.
And tell us why they love it.
And is this the episode where Daisy's just been for the interview at the Woman's Magazine?
Flaps.
That's it, Flaps.
Yeah.
Named one of Radio Times' best podcasts of the year.
I don't understand people who don't see the joy in drawing the curtains, mug of hot chocolate and something nice on TV. Like, what could be nicer than that?
Than having a snuggle.
Exactly.
Nostalgia in bite-sized chunks.
Box of Delights
from Great Big Owl.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you like listening to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
Hey, up! You pop-crazed youngsters, and welcome to the second part of the 53rd episode of Chart Music, the difficult 53rd episode, if you will. Once again, massive apologies for that. My fault, nothing to do with my colleague Sarah B and Simon Price, and on behalf of them, it gives me great pleasure to say, all right then, you pop-crazed youngsters, it is time to get stuck into this episode of Top of the Pops. Always remember, we may go down your favourite band or artist, but we never forget, they've been on Top of the Pops more than we have. Thursday, May the 12th, 1988, and we are 5 months into the reign of the fifth executive producer of Top of the Pops, Paul Tierney, a 46-year-old BBC veteran who got his start on Zocco, the BBC's first attempt as a Saturday morning kids show, hosted by a talking pinball machine, which was made by Janet Ellis's dad in 1969. Yeah. Let's go through his other credits, me dears. So, after that, he did 23 episodes of Jack and Ori in 1969. In 1970, he did Ed and Zed, the Saturday morning kids show which starred Ed Stewart and a robot. Hope and Keane's Crazy House in 1971. Outer Space, another Saturday morning kids show from 1973. Bonnie, a kids show about a female sea captain in 1974. The Hope and Keane scene in 1975. And after a few episodes of Rent-A-Ghost in 1976, he seemed to have taken a break from the BBC, coming back in 1979 to do a couple of series of the Basil Brush show in the Aventys. From there, in 1981, he oversaw the relaunch of Crackerjack for 4 years. Then he did two series of the Keith Harris show. He reunited with the hosts of Crackerjack to produce the Cranky's Electric Comic, while producing 129 episodes of Call My Bluff. And the most recent thing he's done is the recent series of the Kenny Everett television show. I'm detecting a pattern in all of that, aren't you?
In what way?
Kids shows.
Well, yeah, kids shows and light entertainment. And I suppose it's an example, not the first example either, but of Top of the Pops being given to somebody whose track record is in light entertainment rather than the arts. And I know Top of the Pops was never the arty music show, but even so, you can kind of see that in the fingerprints that he leaves on it.
I mean, he'd only do 66 episodes of Top of the Pops. He became HIV positive in the summer of 1989 and would die in 1991. he didn't have much chance to change a lot of things. The two key things he did was in 1989, he started introducing albums back into Top of the Pops. But the main thing is he's the one who brought in all the kids TV presenters. So you've got Simon Parkin, Anthea Turner, Andy Crane, that lot presenting Top of the Pops, which was a bone of contention when we discussed this in a previous episode of Chart Music.
I was definitely, even as a child, as I was at the time, I was definitely kind of like, hang on, what are they doing here? It was just sort of an odd, dissonant kind of thing. Like, you know, because I didn't feel... I suppose, if you think about it, Top of the Pops is quite an awkward thing. It is neither fish nor fowl, you know, where I can imagine there were a lot of furrowed brows over what to do with it and where to put it and how to deal with it, you know. Like, is it light entertainment? Is it kid? No. Is it a kid's show? No. But, you know, and the failure to sort of take it seriously in that way is quite evident in some of its more kind of threadbare periods. But, I didn't really want to see Anthea Turner's, you know, chirpy face. Apart from anything else, I mean, much as I've complained about, you know, the various deficits of different Top of the Pops presenters, it's always weird when you see someone who's really professional about it, as kids TV presenters were at that time, you know, very sort of sharp and on it. And you get that with the sort of the late period, you know, the sort of end days of Top of the Pops. It's Cat Deeley type professionalism.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a little bit, or Anthea Turner type professionalism was just a little bit, just kind of didn't quite fit.
Yeah, I mean, because when I was a kid, I absolutely fucking loved Top of the Pops. But I kind of like the idea that they were presenters for different things. I like the fact that Brian Cant and Fred Harris would never mix with DLT and Tony Blackburn.
Yeah.
Actually, though, I'm thinking a Brian Cant presented Top of the Pops could have been kind of amazing.
Oh, yeah. Definitely, yeah.
Well, they could have gone the whole hog and just, you know, I don't know, get Bagpuss in, get Bagpuss to sit up on the gantry and just awaken.
And then after the number Julian one's Cope. Been on, he goes to sleep and everyone in the fucking studio goes to sleep as well.
that's adorable. I'm just imagining
that's all I want to see now.
And, you know, you'd have the backing dancers would just be the little mice, you know.
Yeah.
Simon Bates as Yaffle.
You could have a dance troupe called Chocolate Biscuit Machine.
I didn't have TV, as I mentioned, because I was I wouldn't have watched it anyway because I was a miserable goth. But had I caught an episode and there was Anthea Turner on it, I'd have been like, "Fuck off, Anthea Turner." That's, you know, that's the last thing I want to see.
Yeah,
really. Yeah, I would have hated that development. But apart from that, it would seem that Paul Charney was mainly given the job as a safe pair of hands.
Mm.
You know, just sort of continuing what had been set in place in the 80s.
Yeah, he had a heck of a CV, really. I mean, I know it's kind of not quite anything like this, but, you know, he's done enough sort of interesting stuff and weird stuff. I can't believe how many series were there of the Keith Harris show.
Enough.
Oh, man, it's never off the fucking telly.
Christ. Yeah, again, even as a kid, found that entire thing just a bit weird and creepy and unfunny and unappealing.
I wonder if it was a BBC ploy to have a pool of presenters who would start off as children's presenters and then grow old with their audience. So there'd be eternal older brothers and sisters. Because by this point, the idea of a TV presenter, you know, in the 70s, it would be, you know, people like Tony Hart and Brian Cant, like kindly uncles. And then by the 80s, these people are, you know, your cooler older brothers' mates or something like that. I think that's happened with people like Philip Schofield. You know what I mean? Started off as a kids' TV presenter and now he's doing whatever shit he's doing now. Fucking
This morning.
Shitty adverts.
Yeah, those terrible adverts that are on all of the time.
I don't know, but I didn't like it. I didn't approve of it. I felt patronised.
Yeah.
But the trouble is, when people are brought in because they chime with a particular generation and then they're allowed to grow old, it means that the next generation along inherits them and is a bit kind of baffled. And that's why, if I can mention the S word, we inherited like monsters like Savile. Mm. And, you know, even leaving aside his crimes, just the presence of that creepy fucking freak. And never mind Savile, DLT. You know, you're just like looking at these people as a child thinking, well, I don't really understand why they are there you wouldn't have had the sort of context or the cultural knowledge to think, well, maybe in my parents' day, they were somehow relevant and young and fashionable, and they're still here because that's their job. It was just this kind of confusion. At least from the sort of late 80s onwards, there was a bit of a turnover.
Yeah.
And people didn't just stay there for fucking ever doing the job.
Yeah, yeah.
It used to be in reverse, didn't it? Because people like Savile and Noel Edmonds, their next move would be to do kids'
true.
Stuff.
True, yeah, very true.
You know, Swap Shop, Jim Will Fix It. And Mike Reed, of course, Saturday Superstore.
Yeah.
Now it's gone the other way around.
The good thing you can say about children's TV presenters is that they're not trying to be cool for the most part. And there's that desperation that I just find really exhausting on the part of a lot of these, you know, the kind of the old guard. Or they're trying to be self-deprecating, but they're trying to be cool. And it's just so knackering. They're very hands up who likes me about themselves. And, you know, somebody like Anthea Turner. Andy Crane, actually, is I'd forgotten. I did think he was really good at it. He was just sort of really natural. But, look, you know how I feel about this. The one true presenter at Top of the Pops for me is Julian Cope, and he only did it the one time. Mm. It was the best day ever.
We are greeted by a blast of The Wizard by Paul Hardcastle, with graphics of dissected guitars, saxophones, cassette tapes and vinyl, but not CDs. Before settling upon the non-more 80s logo of Top of the Pops, which I happen to be wearing right now, on a badge given to me by Gavin Hogg of the Giddy Carousel of Pop, the Smash Hits podcast. They do what we do with Top of the Pops to Smash Hits. So, you know, when you finish listening to us, chuck them a tab.
It's kind of caught somewhere between Tron and Asteroids, the graphics, isn't it? And it's very basic 3D, and the 3D-ness is overdone because it would have been novel at the time. Mm. So, yeah, we are spinning in black space through these kind of blocky notional representations of, as you say, cassette tape, saxophone, guitar, record, and so on. And I guess, I mean, it's hard to be sure at this distance, but I would have been impressed at the time by that. Mm. Viewers would have been impressed because at that point, the idea of even owning a computer would have been like owning a mountain or a nuclear submarine or something.
Yes. I think I was 1 year away from owning a second-hand Amiga. And you certainly couldn't do spinning saxophones on that.
So it's like new stuff, modern stuff, futuristic stuff spinning towards you.
Yeah.
Exciting new stuff.
Yeah, boom, boom, boom. I like these titles. It does definitely engage your brain in a particular way, and it's like, right, prepare to be excited by things.
But saxophones in 1988.
Oh, well, as we now know, thanks to a friend of the podcast, Chris Oakley, the last proper saxophone solo in a pop record was in 1988.
Oh, and?
It was the best. Not simply the best, just the best by Tina Turner.
Thank you for getting that right.
It's important.
Unless, of course, you know better.
Unless you know better, I want to know. I'm still, you know, he's done amazing work researching this, but I'm intrigued to know if any Dre ones in the 90s.
Yes, thank you very much, Chris.
When was Curtis Steiger's? Because that was his whole thing, wasn't it? Playing the sax. That was the 90s, wasn't it? I don't know.
Your host for this evening, Mike Reed, who is now 41, and now a strictly weekend fixture at Radio 1, hosting Singled Out, the renamed Round Table, on Friday tea times, holding down the 10 a.m. slot on Saturday mornings between Peter Powell and Adrian Just, and manning Jimmy Savile's oldies slot on Sunday dinner times. Your other host, Simon Mayo, who joined Radio 1 from Radio Nottingham 2 years ago, and has started the year as Janice Long's replacement for the evening show, which was the old Kid Jensen slot, which is currently sandwiched between Bruno Brooks and John Peel. He's also become the new host of the school's quiz show, Pop of the Form, taking over from Mike Reed, and in 11 days' time, he will be the new host of The Breakfast Show, ripping Mike Smith down from the alpha male position of Radio 1. Oh, chaps, Simon Mayo, 29, Mike Reed, 41. Here are two people going in the opposite direction on Radio 1.
Yes, they are. Yeah, I mean, Mike Reed is a ghost of a man at this point. He's you know, as you say, he's no longer doing Saturday Superstar, he's no longer doing Pop Quiz. And his status as a kind of central figure in BBC Entertainment is fading. He's still clinging onto Radio 1 just about, but only Saturday mornings. And he's got a biker jacket with the sleeves rolled up.
Yes.
But the jacket is way too new, and it screams a midlife crisis.
Yes,
I think,
yes.
Isn't it? And yeah, you can sense the simmering tension here. There's no rapport.
No.
No chemistry. It's very much you say your bit and I'll say mine.
Mm.
A bit like when me and Taylor are on Chart Music. he knows...
If you and Taylor are Simon Mayo, I might read Who's Who.
No comment.
Yeah, come on. Sarah, Who's Who?
No. I'm not going there. But he knows that Mayo is the rising star. He's the younger man, as you say. He's 29. And at this point...
The mayonnaise rises to the top.
The mayonnaise rises to the top, yeah. You know, he, as you say, he's doing the evening slot, but only 2 months later, he's being given Mike Read's old job on Breakfast. That's got to hurt.
Mm.
That's got to hurt Mike Read.
Mm.
I mean, Mayo is not particularly cool himself. He's not like a hip young guy. He's in a bad beige jacket with the sleeves rolled up.
Yeah.
But the crucial thing is, Mayo... And I don't have any problem with Simon Mayo, by the way. I think he's all right. You know, I've got no animosity towards him. But one thing that's in his favour here, he isn't desperate to appear cool.
No.
And Reed is.
Yeah.
When Reed comes out with his car crash, non-wise cracks, Mayo has the decency to look embarrassed for him.
Mm.
Mayo's whole shtick is being the everyman that... The choric role, as he calls it on the film show he does on Five Live with Mark Kermode.
Yeah.
And he's already doing it here, really, because he's... I feel that if you just look at his expression when Mike Read makes a non-joke, that Mayo is channeling the audience's mixture of discomfort and pity towards Mike Read.
Yeah. I mean, it is tough to be the straight man if the other guy is not funny, you know, if the other guy is not... That's a tough gig, man. But like, it is hard to do when you're wearing your mum's jacket. I mean, Mike Read has objectively the better jacket here, even if it's not really his jacket in any meaningful sense.
Mm, yeah.
But you know, it's 1988. What are you going to do? I mean, I don't mind Simon Mayo at all. I mean, you know, very much like the condiment that bears his name, sort of bland but reliable with. Many applications.
Yes. One of the few former Radio 1 DJs and Top of the Pops who isn't making an arse of himself these days and has actually carved a really nice niche for himself.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's the sort of presenter that I prefer in that he's got that slight dryness. It's that, you know, very sort of English, kind of very slight kind of, without being fully kind of eye-rolly cynical or mugging. He doesn't mug, you know, he's not a mugger. So, you know, I mean, he's not John Peel, but nor is he Noel fucking Edmonds, you know, and... I mean, he's not Kid Jensen either, but, you know, who is? So, you know, I'll take it.
And Reed is mugging like a motherfucker here, isn't he?
Oh, yes.
You know, from the very start, he's shouting in a Cockney accent and waving banknotes around, and he goes top of the wads and promises the show will have loads of singers, mainly tenors.
Mm. Oh.
And it took me a while to realise what he's doing, which we're going to come to, because, right, it falls into that pattern of Reed saying something that has the shape and the rhythm of a joke, but isn't actually a joke. He's so desperate to be funny, but he can't carry it off. Never could.
No.
Well, I mean, the thing about Simon Mayo is every time he was on Top of the Pops, he always looked like the central character in a young person's bank account advert. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah.
And as is the style of this era, he has got his sleeves rolled up on his horrible baggy thing.
Mm.
But rolling up the sleeves of a leather jacket, Sarah, this has been on my mind ever since I wanted to do this episode. Your thoughts, rolling up the sleeves on a leather jacket.
We have discussed this before, I believe.
You made quite an impassioned defence of the rolling the sleeves up thing with
I'm
against
pro.
David's opinions.
Yeah, I'm fully for it.
Even a leather jacket.
Even a leather jacket. The thing with a leather jacket is you don't. It's
oh,
not.
Man.
It's a different. No. It's all in the technique, right? Because you're not rolling up the sleeves. It's more of a shunt. It's just a kind of light shunt. So you don't roll it all the way up. So you're just exposing.
Yes.
It's quite nice because it's, you know, the leather jacket is kind of the the uniform of the rebel and the malcontent and everything. And you're giving it a little bit of a. A slightly feminine edge by exposing your wrist and just a whisper of forearm, you know, so you're just taking the edge off the style a little bit. And, you know, that is a good...
I don't think everyone can get away with it. I think certain people can get away with it. Jacko, in the Beat It video, can get away
with it. Yeah,
yeah. That red leather with jacket, the zips, yeah, where it's pushed up. Oh God, I wanted that jacket.
I had a t-shirt of that jacket, like printed on the t-shirt. It was great.
Oh my God. Simon Le Bon can get away with it as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But Mike Reed, not so
much. No. I mean,
on Mike Reed, it looks like, you know, if the hairy bikers were vets instead of cooks, that's what they'd be wearing.
The hairy vets. Like,
he's just got off his bike and he's about to plunge his fist up a cow's arse. It's not right. And also with a leather jacket, and particularly with a new leather jacket, it would take a lot of effort to roll that up.
Yeah, there's no, you can't fight it too much. Yeah, and if it's new and it's all kind of, you know, sort of creaky still. But no, we do have quite an assortment of various vintages of leather jacket in this house. And I mean, my bloke, he does it partly because his arms are slightly longer than the average, so he, you know, and you don't want the kind of, you don't want it to just naturally end just above your wrist because it looks dark.
Doesn't want to show wrist.
No, just don't, it's got to be wrist and a couple of inches of forearm. That's like, you know, that's the ideal. So yeah, and I'll do it as well. I've got one that is more comfortable to just sort of shunt up a bit. And I mean, obviously, women are kind of, we can get away with stuff without people like us going, "Ooh, what are you doing? You're rolling up your sleeves."
Yeah.
But still, you know, I think it's fine. It's partly you've got to. It's like anything; you have to just be able to carry it off with a sort of what, you know, and that is kind of laugh proof. You know, you're not going to get someone going, look at you with your stupid jackets, like, what?
Which is the first thing that came out of my mouth.
Yeah, but that's because,
this episode.
That's because, bless him, Mike Reed cannot pull off a leather jacket, especially not, this is a, you know, this is kind of close to the platonic ideal of a leather jacket, I think, with the, you know, with that collar, even though he's popped the collar, but, you know, but that's a good leather jacket, but not on him, because
he's Eric Cantona or something.
But he's, you know, he's wearing it like a suit jacket, really, because, you know, he's wearing it like a blazer, which you can't do. So, but I don't know. I mean, I have the most rudimentary fashion sense. I'm kind of skidding inexorably towards just wearing one sort or another of pyjamas, indoors, outdoors, whatever, as I think a lot of people are at the minute. But, you know, leather jackets, I would say, you are allowed to shunt them up.
Sarah, as rudimentary as you may consider your fashion sense to be, I think you're allowed to have a go at Mike Reed. I think you are in a position that you can do that, trust.
Oh, is it punching what is it, punching down or is it punching across? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. But
just as long as you punch him, Doug.
Just as long as you punch him.
He wouldn't feel it in that jacket. It looks pretty tough to me.
I couldn't help noticing that there are many, many leather jackets in this episode of Top of the Pops. Possibly more than are in Sarah B's house. So in a way, you know, Mike Reed with his leather jacket is foreshadowing the entire show, isn't he? So many jackets.
Yes.
He's with it.
Oh. He's with it. Definitely with it.
Oi, you! Shut your mouth and watch this show!
I think what Mike is trying to say is he's got a pretty good program coming up.
We've got loads of acts, we've got loads of singers, mainly tenors, on Top of the Woods!
In other words, on Top of the Pops at number 4, Harry Enfield with an awful lot of money.
Oi, you! Shut your mouth and look at my wall! Yeah, money!
This is a journey into money. Loads of money.
Money. It's loads of money. Reed! In midlife crisis sunglasses, a black t-shirt and a leather jacket with the sleeves rolled up, immediately launches into an appalling impersonation of the comedy sensation of the moment, while Mayo, in a horrible puffy taupe suit jacket with the sleeves also rolled up and a navy and white hoopy top, acts as straight man, while assorted kids who have been lacerated by the late 80s stick surround them and whoop and gurn.
The fucking crowd, man.
Yeah.
They're, oh my God, they're the squares, aren't they? The squares. It's the invasion of the squares. Because, you know, in previous Top of the Pops, earlier in the 80s, we might moan about zoo wankers or the people who look like they wanted to be zoo wankers.
Yeah.
Fucking clothes horses and show ponies.
Yeah.
People who look like they've been only just turned away from the Blitz Club but desperately wanted to get in and, you know, all those sort of people. Fucking bless them. At least they were going for it.
Yes.
Trying something. This lot with their fucking waistcoats and their floppy hats and just kind of grey and beige and just, oh, God. They're neither fashionable nor unfashionable. They're just sort of there.
Yeah.
Fucking hell.
They're like the extras in the Who Me YTS advert.
Right.
You know, the one where one of them kicks a can about and then Graham Taylor leans out the window and signs him up or for something, I don't know. Fucking lies.
Yeah.
While Reed wears a half-smug, half-embarrassed smile at his own shitness, Mayo introduces us to the first act, who's just had their catchphrase ruined. It's Loads of Money, Doing Up the House by Harry Enfield. Created by Paul Whitehouse and Charlie Higson for Harry Enfield in 1988, Loads of Money was a plasterer who was based on Spurs fans who would wave £10 notes at away fans from the north. After making his debut on the Channel 4 comedy show Friday Night Live in February of this year, Loads of Money immediately took off, working both as a satire on rampant C2 Thatcherism or as a blatant celebration of the Southern boom, depending on which side of the fence you were. As the latest series of Friday Night Live, which had practically turned into the show with Loads of Money on it, wound down at the end of last month, Enfield cashed in with a novelty single on Mercury Records with the assistance of Crunch Groove, one of the pseudonyms of William Orbit. It entered the charts last week at number 17, and this week it soared 13 places to number 4, and here are Enfield, Whitehouse and Higson in the studio. Number fucking 4. Ugh. Where do we start with this?
Oh, man.
I mean, in 3 months, Loads of Money's absolutely blown up across the UK. He's just been the guest reviewer in the latest issue of Smash Hits, where he gives the following review for Single of the Century, Loads of Money, Doing Up the House. This is the best record ever made. It's exactly like Beethoven, except without all that classical music rubbish and disco instead.
Okay, so musically, if you can say that, let's just get that out of the way. I mean, it's yeah. not, is it? It's sort of, it's like a heap of fragments. And it's just, it's very, very hard work. I mean, it's like a sort of musical aneurysm and you sort of get what it's getting at, but why? It is just, you're kind of like, why have you done this? Especially when I discovered it was William Orbit, which I didn't realise. It's like, what the fuck? Mm. William Orbit responsible for one of my favourite records ever, Fascinating Rhythm, you know? And it's like, what are you doing, man? You know, I know everyone's got to make money and stuff, but it's very odd, isn't it? And especially for, like, you know, the first, you know, the opener of the Top of the Pops.
Mm.
It's so strange. And you know that it's satire and you know what it's satirizing and you can kind of put all that together. But again, you're just left with this really empty feeling of like, why has everyone involved done this? Yeah. What's the sequence of events? What decisions led to this? You know?
Yeah. It's like you've ordered Pump Up the Volume by Mars on Wish.com, isn't it? Follows the rules of dance music of the time. I mean, the samples and pastiches are just layer upon layer. So you start off with the Paid in Full remix. You know, this is a journey into money. You Really Got Me. Hey Big Spender. An actual sample of Money, Money, Money by ABBA. Mm. You know, a year after the Jam sampled Dancing Queen and got the fucking arses ripped off them for it.
Mm.
Money Makes the World Go Round from Cabaret. Buffalo Girls, you know, all this scratching's making me rich. They've got the bass line or whatever to Money, That's What I Want. And, of course, I Know You Got Soul and then Sing a Song of Sixpence. So it's lots of songs about money just mashed together. So, you know, getting William Orbit in is a good move because he is obeying the rules. It is a dance record.
Well, sort of, but
silence.
You know.
I'm not trying to defend it. It's awful.
No, it's really grim. I mean, and the thing is that it's a comedy. Well, okay, if it's a comedy song, it's more. It's not really a song, and nor is it especially funny. So why? What's, you know, what is this endeavour supposed to achieve? I just really got a real kind of injection of that to the brain. It's quite depressing. I mean, the thing is that this isn't even the low point of this episode, for fuck's sake.
No.
But not by a long shot.
God.
But it is that there are, you know, as we will speak of later, something that does something very similar, but somehow worse. But it's... Oh, God, so I was making my notes and it's like, it's trying to, what's it doing? It's sending up stuff like S Express. And I was like, oh, God, sending up is such a horrible phrase and it's appropriate, you know, because it's not.
It's Essex Express, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but you see, that you just pulled out of your ass is actually more clever and amusing than anything in this kind of 3 minute upset.
I mean, the BBC would have been very happy to have the top comedy star at the moment on their channel. So they've pushed the boat out somewhat by actually allowing the video to be played in the top corner.
Oh, yeah.
At the same time.
Oh, yeah, they kind of cut to and fro, don't they?
There's lots of prop money being thrown about, which apparently has been especially printed up and features loads of money with his arm around the Queen, who's winking at us, and it's got bank of wads of dosh printed across the top. So, yeah, as far as production standards go, BBC have pushed the boat out a bit on here, I think.
Paul Whitehouse is there just kind of looking gormless. I guess he's supposed to be, I don't know what the idea is there, he's supposed to be just out
of it. He's Lance, the YTS lad.
Oh, right, okay. I don't know. But, you know, and they start kind of actually destroying some decks with saws and then finally a colossal comedy hammer.
Yes.
A really, really big one that looks quite solid. And, you know, it is on record that I love the use of props on Top of the Pops, but not like this. Not like this. You're just wantonly destroying things for no reason. And the idea is that it's going, hey, you all know what this is, and you all know how absurd it is when people go on Top of the Pops and all they have is decks and they're just dancing and like miming. I mean, even though everyone did.
Yeah.
There's a slightly sour element of superiority in the whole thing, but it doesn't land in any way. It's like, it's supposed to be subversive, isn't it? But at this point, it's not going to land. And loads of money has become kind of stripped, I think, by now of its sort of satirical punch, if it ever had any in the first place. So, yeah, I'm just depressing myself talking about it. Please, someone else say something.
Simon, I mean, you didn't have a telly, so what did you know of Loads of Money?
Well, you couldn't avoid it, even if you didn't have a telly. It was just this huge cultural fact. You would run into it somewhere at somebody else's house or on somebody's T-shirt, or it was just everywhere. I've got to say, watching this performance is the least fun I've had doing a chart music. And I'm sorry to say that, but, you know, because I love recording this podcast with you guys, but this felt like fucking work. I hate this. I hate this more than anything we've covered on chart music. And I include in that B.A. Robertson and Oasis and anyone, really.
Jesus.
First of all, Harry Enfield himself is despicable.
Right.
We've seen that as recently as this year. When he was defending the use of blackface. I mean, that's the hill he's decided to die on. Do you remember when things were being removed from Netflix and so on, like Little Britain and various other things due to having used blackface? Well, Harry Enfield, went on Radio 4 defending having done that himself. He, of course, blackfaced up as Nelson Mandela.
Yes.
He portrayed Mandela as selling drugs and alco pops to kids. And his argument was, well, that was the stereotype of black people, and he was subverting that by basically repeating the fucking stereotype, right? And that's exactly what he's doing here. In 1988, we didn't have the word chav and we didn't have the word cosplay, but this is chav cosplay. That's what it is. And when you get things like this, I guess, like, you know, Lee Nelson, Vicky Pollard, things like that, it always feels like punching down to me. It always leaves a sour taste. I suppose there are the odd thing that I'll give a pass to, like Paul Karff, because, you know, Steve Coogan's not posh himself, and Ali G, because it's done with intelligence. But I just think that the supposed satire going on here just does not work and never did from the beginning. It's you know, it's meant to be a satire of Thatcherite avarice, but as you said yourself, Al, it was taken by a lot of people as a celebration of that.
Alf Garnett syndrome.
Now, anybody could have seen that coming, right? Obviously, loads of people.
Sorry, it's the only time I'm going to do that.
Many people thought it was something to aspire to.
Yeah.
But Harry Enfield is an educated man, expensively educated man. He should have seen this coming. And I'm always saying this about things like Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen or Rockin' in the Free World by Neil Young, that if you write some kind of big fist-pumping patriotic chorus, if people don't read the small print and don't read the verses, that's on you. It really is. And I think it's on Harry Enfield here that everybody just took it as a celebration of being a kind of crass, newly minted Essex man in a tracksuit. And that whole thing you mentioned, Al, of him basing it on Cockney fans, football fans, waving wads of money at Liverpool supporters. Well, this only escalated it. People were doing it even more on the back of this. People in football stadiums were shouting loads of money and waving wads of money at, you know, Liverpool supporters if they were from London or something like that.
I'm guessing you never saw Saturday Live or Friday Night Live as it was by this point.
Oh, maybe once or twice, but I didn't like it. You know? He did that kebab shop man as well, didn't he? Like, yeah, and that was dodgy as fuck as well. I mean, oh, God.
Channel 4 moved it this year to Friday nights, which practically invented their Friday night comedy strand. And it was also a repository for the sort of bands that Channel 4 sorts liked. You know, this series that has just ended featured Voice of the Beehive, Fergal Sharkey, Hue and Cry, The Communards, Magnum, Madness, The Primitives, Roachford, Eurythmics, The Christians, Squeeze, Hot House Flowers, and Was Not Was. And a month ago, they got the Pogues on to do Streets of Sorrow and Birmingham Six, but they cut to an ad break without telling them before they got to the Birmingham Six bit.
Right, yeah.
So in this context, I mean, Ben Elton introduced loads of money in the first episode of the new series, saying, oh, you know, we've moved to Friday night, we've got a new set, one of the plasterers who came in, he's got something to say. And that's how loads of money was introduced, as practically a hate figure for Channel 4 sorts.
Yeah, so everyone can laugh at the idea of plasterers, you know, because they're so common, and but they've got a bit of money. And Enfield's idea of how to portray that is to jut his chin out and talk in a horrible mangled Estuarine accent, and to walk in a sort of bandy-legged way, because that's what he thinks working class people are, you know. And just his idea of hip-hop is equally patronising and outdated. You've got to remember, by this point, we'd already had fucking comedy hip-hop records like Wicker Rap by The Evasions, and that John McEnroe one that I can't remember the name of now.
The Brat.
Yeah, and Morris Major and the Minors, or Minor and the Majors, whatever it was. And, you know,
which also came from Saturday Live.
Right.
So there you go.
So, the thing is with this one is that Enfield and his, I guess he and William Orbit, but whoever else was responsible for this, for a start, they conflate house music and hip-hop. It's as if the only thing they've heard is the Beatmasters. You know, they just think hip-hop and house is the same thing. Oh, it's all that stuff. It's all that kind of, like fake machine music that young people like. Let's sort of jumble it all together and make fun of it. And
it's all a bit of a cod.
Yeah. And these are people like B.A. Robertson and like Jonathan King who hate pop, right? They certainly hate hip-hop and house. They disdain it. And they think it's easy, right? This record implies that it's a piece of piss to make a hip-hop record. But ironically, it only serves to show that it isn't, you know.
It's more of a pastiche of house music than hip-hop, I'd say.
Well, it's both, because you've got the bit, all the scratching's making me rich, and then the DJ runs his needle across the grooves, not inside them. You know, he thinks it's self-evident to any decent, right-minded person that hip-hop is A, easy, and B, shit. Right. And I think that was a prevalent view. It really was. It was really hard to fight that off in my circles, because if you were into kind of alternative rock music, there's a lot of that among indie fans. This is why the war broke out at NME, because a lot of people thought hip hop wasn't even music.
Well, yeah, I mean, it really is showing it's saying so much more about them than they would have wanted to. You know, it's very, very complacent. It's very patronizing. You know, the entire thing. And it's like, oh, we are, you know, we will effortlessly skewer this thing that we haven't really cared to learn anything about. You know, I mean, if you're going to satirize something, there needs to be like a base level of respect for it in order to know enough about it to be that precise, you know. And obviously there's nothing precise about this. It's just a kind of mush of snottiness and self-congratulation. I mean, I do think if you're making a thing, whether it's comedy, drama or whatever, you can't allow yourself to be too cowed by the worst possible interpretation of it. You know, you can't go, who's the most literal-minded shitbag that will have access to this work and how will they interpret it? You can't kind of cow to that. However, I'm not sure that really applies here because, yeah, you are walking straight into it. And irony only works if everyone buys into it. It's, you know, much like social distancing, in fact. Like, it only works. I can social distance from you, but then if you don't do the same thing, then it's broken and I have broken it because you've broken it. So, you know, this is kind of recursive collapse of whatever patina of irony there was on this is just... In this context, they've just dispensed with it, really. Mm. It's like, oh, well, you know, people like this, and who cares why they like it, and let's just barrel ahead and get to number... What number is this
four.
At?
Four. Fuck me.
Four. Let's get to number four. Also, I discovered that Higson and Whitehouse did get royalties from this record, but they didn't have a formal contract. Mm. They lost out on the rights to the Loads of Money character, even though they co-created it. So they just got a fee in the first place, and then Harry Enfield went on and did adverts for, like, Seconda and stuff. And half the royalties from this went to ABBA anyway.
Yes.
And then Harry Enfield. So, I mean, there's kind of meta-ironies in that, Harry Enfield going on to do those cheeky adverts. Oh, it's cheeky. I mean, it's proto-Bantz, isn't it, really? And it's that horrible thing where you now get anything... unpleasant or wrong-headed or outdated or generally unhelpful is going to get waved away by Arts Bants, and then it's on you because the failure of humour is on you.
Oh, if you can't take a joke.
Yeah. Can't take a joke. And I've had a fucking bellyful of that, to be honest, and there is a thing like this for me later, but orders of magnitude worse. It's like an attempt to drill down to the centre of the earth.
Right about this time, he's asked the Sun for a retraction after they used a picture of Loads of Money on the front page to promote their bingo game without his permission. The Sun responded by printing a story called Loads of Monies, where Stan Boardman, Jimmy Cricket and Max Bygraves told him how lucky he was to be promoted by the Sun. And they also issued an editorial which read, "Shut your mouth and look at our wad. Seriously, we believe you should buy yourself a decent sense of humour." This could well be the stage where alternative comedy stops being alternative. But at the moment, it's still them and us. And Harry Enfield's still on the side of us.
Hang on, is the implication that he objected to being on the front of the Sun politically, or just that he wanted to be paid for it?
I'm not sure. I'm guessing, you know, this is pre-Hillsborough, but I'm guessing comics of his status didn't want to be associated with the Sun.
Yeah, well, he did plenty enough damage without needing their help. Honestly, right, I'm not exaggerating that Loads of Money is in the sort of top five, maybe top three things in the late 80s that made me feel... alienated from British culture, just made me despise this country, and made me glad when I got out for a year when I fucked off to France in late 88, and it's just good to get away from this fucking cesspit that it was becoming, because of stuff like this being celebrated and aspired to, which, just to repeat myself, but Enfield should have seen that coming.
Maybe he did and he didn't give a shit, that's the thing.
Exactly, he didn't give a shit and he sold loads of videos, but he did, yeah, sold loads of VHSs and T-shirts and whatever else off the back of it.
I mean, the thing that would have offended me at the time is that, what's this shit doing on? Why don't you put some proper dance music on?
But that's exactly it, Al. It's a given for this posh cunt that hip-hop is rubbish. And I would imagine a lot of people at the BBC, at Top of the Pops, would have kind of agreed with him. So they were happier to put, by the way, not one but two, actually not two but three parody hip-hop records on this show than give any kind of airtime to real hip-hop.
There's a direct diss in here, by the way. I don't know if you picked it up, where he says, Derek B on your bike.
Yes.
Rude.
Yes. So the following week, Loads of Money doing up the house dropped two places to number six, and he never troubled the charts again.
Good.
As it turned out, and as Sarah's pointed out, the single failed to raise a substantial amount of cash for co-creators Whitehouse and Higson when they realised that 50% of the royalties had to go to ABBA for the Money, Money, Money sample, and they didn't have a formal contract with Enfield, which meant he got what was left, and all revenue from an advertising campaign with Seconda Watchers later that year. After Friday Night Live was cancelled by Channel 4 and Loads of Money was referenced in speeches by both Neil Kinnock and Margaret Thatcher, he was killed off in March of 1989 after giving Comic Relief a massive cheque for 10p and then being knocked down by a Ford Sierra outside the BBC studios. And a year later, Enfield appeared in The Sun again under the headline Bish Bosh, I've Spent All Me Dosh, where he revealed that he'd lost a fortune on property deals, but he became a full-on BBC man in 1990 with the sketch show Harry Enfield's television programme.
Pump up the football, pump up the football.
Sing a song of sixpence, a bucket full of dosh. Dibble, 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 bosh, bosh, bosh. Sing a song of sixpence.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
What a great way to start Top of the Pops. Harry Enfield with Loads of Money. Here's a guy who doesn't need loads of money because he's got lots already. At number 9 this week, Prince with Alphabet Street.
Loitering around the side of the studio with the kids, including a goth girl with a ridiculous permy quiff and her mate, tells us what a great start to the show that was and that the next act is properly minted. It's Prince with Alphabet Street. We've covered Prince in Chart Music number 30, and this single, the follow-up to I Could Never Take the Place of Your Man, which got to number 25 in December of 1987, is the lead cut from his 10th official LP, Love Sexy, which came out at the beginning of the week. It entered the charts at number 18 last week, and this week it soared 9 places to number 9. And here's a sliver of the video, which features him princing about in front of some computer-generated graphics. Simon, at last, Prince, proper Prince.
Can I shock you?
No, surely not.
I don't love this.
Oh,
no?
Don't you?
Here's the thing. Of all the Prince records that are any good, it's one of the least good. It's doing an impression of a great song.
Right.
It seems on the surface of it to be a great 3-minute, 3-chord pop song.
Mm.
It's doing all the moves, pulling all the moves of a great pop song. Even the fact of being called Alphabet Street, you just think A, B, C, it's just simplicity and all of that.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to say it's Shaking Kiss, but but it's Kiss Light, it's Diet Kiss, it's Kiss Zero. It's got the same trebly sound range and the same use of space and silence, the same very minimal production.
Mm.
And don't get me wrong, right? It's better than anything else in this episode of Top of the Pops by a million miles. Sorry to spoiler that, but it is. It's fucking Prince, right? If I was making a mix CD, remember making mix CDs for people rather than fucking Spotify plays. If I was making a mix CD of the best of Prince, which I have done many times for many people, obviously this has to be on it because it's expected. It's one of the biggies.
Mm.
But I don't love it. It leaves me a little bit cold. It's a little clunky rather than funky, I would say, in places. And I probably sound like a real sort of entitled, spoiled cunt for saying that because it's Prince and it's a good record, but it's just not right up there. The song actually picks up in the full length version, the album version, or the 12 inch version, where you've got Cat Glover coming in doing a rap, going, "Talk to me, lover, come and tell me what you taste." And that line, by the way, corroborates a theory about the song, which I guess we're going to come to. And you know that bit of "jerk your body like a horny pony."
Yeah, jerk your body like a horny pony.
Well done. Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it? That bit. Obviously, yeah. There's a theory that it's about cunnilingus, specifically the alphabet technique, where you spell out each letter of the alphabet with your tongue. I don't know about that, but yeah, that bit where Kat goes, "Tell me what you taste," does seem to sort of back that up. Mm. It's the lead cut from Love Sexy, which I would say the last of his run of indisputably great albums.
Yes.
Not that he didn't make great records after that,
yeah,
but he had that unbroken run, probably from his debut, but certainly from Dirty Mind, right through to Love Sexy, just masterpiece after masterpiece. Mm. In hindsight, also, though, Love Sexy was what I would call the start of his bullshit, right?
Yeah.
Because there's this whole conceptual thing going on about the battle between Christ, who is Love Sexy, and the devil, who is Spooky Electric. And some of that plays out in the extended Alphabet Street, indeed. Mm. But there, I mean, as a fan, there's stuff on the album that just blows my mind and sends shivers through me, like Anastasia.
Mm.
It's just one of the greatest things, just greatest piece of music of that decade, greatest things he ever did. The album had only come out 2 days before this episode of Top of the Pops.
Did you buy it?
Yeah, I did. I probably hadn't really had a chance to digest it all yet. 2 months after this Top of the Pops, I went to see him, my first ever Prince gig, and it was the Love Sexy tour. Did you see him, Al, on that tour?
Only on Channel 4.
Oh, right, okay. So, anyway,
they broadcast a gig from Germany live.
Right, yeah. So you know the whole setup that he had this big sort of hydraulic open-top car that he's going round, and there's a bed, and he plays a bit of basketball, and there's all this kind of all this shit going on, and it was just amazing. And also, sorry if I divert a bit or digress into talking about the gig and about Prince in general, but
no, go ahead.
As a fan, and I couldn't afford to own all his records yet at that stage. It's not like now, you can just fucking nick it all off the internet.
Yeah.
I could maybe borrow a couple of things off mates and tape them, but there were holes in my knowledge of his catalogue. So he starts off with Erotic City, which I'd never heard before. It's actually the B-side of Let's Go Crazy, 12-inch. Mm. That just blew me away. Just to open the song I'd never heard before, like, where the fuck did that come from? And then midway through, there's just him on his own with electric guitar, and he plays this blinding melodic new wave guitar song solo, which I'd never heard before, which was When You Were Mine.
Yeah.
Imagine hearing that for the first time and hearing it live, him in front of you, and you're thinking, what, is this new? Where did this come from?
Yeah.
So just the whole experience was overwhelming. I remember even getting to the gig was this weird kind of Road to Damascus or Pilgrimage to Lourdes kind of situation, because it was a boiling hot July day and I couldn't afford public transport to get there. I was so skint. I had to walk from my then girlfriend's house, which is in Crouch End, all the way to Wembley, which, if you know your London geography, is a fucking long walk, actually.
Mm.
And I walked all the way there. By the time I got there, I was like dehydrated. And at the end of the gig, I thought, did I hallucinate the whole fucking thing? Because it was that good. So, yeah, I've got a lot of love for Love Sexy, a lot of great memories associated with it because of that. I think with Alphabet Street, because he pushed the boat out artistically quite far with the Sign of the Times album, which is obviously a total masterpiece, probably his greatest album,
that or
Parade. I think there was probably pressure to start this campaign with a hit, right? Mm. So Alphabet Street has got "hit" written all over it, hasn't it?
Yes.
He recorded it in the festive perineum of 87, 30th of December, just before New Year's Eve, Paisley Park, which he'd only just paid for and built with, you know, all his, I guess, Purple Rain millions.
Mm.
The next day, he played a benefit gig in Minneapolis for the homeless, the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. He used to do these kind of like benefit gigs with Miles Davis as his guest.
Oh.
And they played this song together. Well, it was part of the finale of the gig was this interminable funk jam, "It's Gonna Be a Beautiful Night," which people will know from the Sign of the Times album. But quite often that would just turn into like a 20-minute, 30-minute funk jam with whatever else thrown in. And he's throwing in bits of Mother Popcorn and Cold Sweat by James Brown and all kinds of stuff like that. But he throws in a bit of Alphabet Street. Now, I've listened to a bootleg of it And I've scanned through it quite a lot and I can't find that bit. So I don't know if it's almost unrecognisable. But yeah, in theory, the world's first performance of this song was with Miles Davis, Blowing Hard, you know. So yeah, that's a nice bit of history to it. I feel like I've got some stuff to say about the lyrics and about the video, but I've been wanging on about it for quite a bit, so I need to let Sarah in.
That's fine.
Sarah, as a 10-year-old, what's Prince saying to you at this time?
I didn't quite know what to make of Prince yet, but this would definitely have been a good sort of gateway to Prince at that time.
Yes.
Because it's such a joy, it's so playful. I mean, I yield to Simon on his Prince knowledge, but for me this is just one of the most joyous sounds I know. I mean, if it comes on anywhere, I will bust a move. I have to. You know, and I will go on the floor and I will do the popular squirrel dance. You know, it's just, that's what's going to happen. It's got this kind of, I'm sure, yeah, it is like he could have done this in his sleep, but it's got such a kind of positive current in it, you know. And it's, and of course, any suggestion of rudeness would have gone way over my head, but there's a clear and present naughtiness about it, you know. It's really obviously rude in some way. But it's just it's very happy. It's very positively charged. It's like a sort of quite an explosion of serotonin and probably other things. But, you know. Yeah, I mean, but in terms of the video as it's placed here, I mean, after the slog of loads of money, you know, it's such an emotional roller coaster, this episode.
God, yes.
What are you doing
to
it?
Actually.
Jesus. And you go, yeah, it's fucking Prince. And it's such a, you know, thank God. But it's a meatloaf moment, isn't it? It's like you play, you go from some horrible British sludge that is a real insult to everyone's intelligence, and then a flash of American brilliance for a minute and 40 seconds, and then they just snatch it away and replace it with something shitter. No spoilers, but it's like, oh, thanks.
I mean, my relationship with Prince is very similar to David Bowie. And, you know, when they both died in the same year, I got the same feeling. Oh, this is fucking horrible. But I know so many other people who it's going to hurt more. And I immediately thought of them. I mean, as I've said before, when I was at college, you could divide people into two camps, Morrissey people and Prince people. And you always wanted to be around the Prince people.
I was both, so catch me on a good day. You know, you might want to hang around with me.
But I had a mate who just dealt me a tape of Love Sexy right away. And I had the same feeling as you, Simon. I heard this before I heard the album. I thought, oh, here we go again. And, you know, I've gone back and listened to Love Sexy this past week. And, yeah, after Sign of the Times, anything's going to be a bit of a, not going to say disappointment, but, it's not grabbing me as much as Sign of the Times did. But, of course, before then, I'd heard the Black Album.
Yeah.
And I know you had that, Simon.
Yeah, I got a bootleg from Camden for £20, yeah.
Mm.
Which is a lot of money in those days, yeah.
Didn't see Prince live that year, but I did see the Sign of the Times concert, which comes out in the UK, I think, a month after this.
Which is weird timing, yeah.
Yeah, massively weird timing. And the abiding memory of that, apart from the bit where he slides across the floor under Cat's legs and pulls a bloody skirt off with his teeth. And God knows I've tried that so many times and failed so many times. Just before the film starts, it starts getting dark in the cinema, and someone in the audience said, you know, everybody in the house go, and my mate, who was with his girlfriend, so he was sat a few rows behind me and me other mates, just shouts, how about everybody just shut the fuck up? And that's my main reminder of that film. But yeah, I mean, the video, all 1 minute and 20 seconds or whatever it is, I mean, it would have seemed massively futuristic in 1988, but like the Michael Jackson video for You Are Not Alone, it's not aged well, has it?
No, it's dated really badly. These floating letters of the alphabet going around him. I mean, first of all, just about Prince himself, he looks really beautiful.
Oh, yeah. It goes without saying.
Yeah, it does. But even by his standards, he's wearing some lovely clothes. He's got this kind of mint green and black colour scheme going on. He's moved on from peach and black. He's got this mint green shirt, polka dots, and these boots. And he's going through a big polka dot phase, actually, around this time. And lovely, long, wavy hair.
Yes.
But the video itself just looks really cheap.
Yes.
or the floating letters of the alphabet.
It's kind of like they fed Prince and a car and some legs into a word processor and then kind of sat on it.
Oh, he's gone down the Trocadero.
I went to look at the full version. I mean, not very much, to be fair, not very much else happens. I mean, you've got, you know, basically it's a kind of Prince riding on the floor in some tracky bottoms emblazoned with the word Prince, which I would love some of those.
You know, when you've got a pair of trousers with your name on them, you know you succeeded at life. Unless you call Joe Bloggs or Giorgio.
His mum sewed that on. It's in case he lost them at school.
He'd lost them so many times. Prince! Right on, like, taking up half the thigh.
You should have got some Simon with Price down the side.
Oh, trust me, I've thought about it. I've actually photoshopped, you know, Price and the Revolution as a little kind of logo. That was my Facebook profile pic for a while.
So, yeah, I mean, there's a nice selection of things, like a sort of box of chocolates of Prince, you know, Prince's best moves, you know, shot of Prince's bare chest that you sort of linger on for slightly too long. Prince pretending to drive, and then Prince kind of actually driving. Mm. Prince crawling after some legs,
yes,
some
yes.
heels. And Prince's eye with extra eyebrow. And, you know, but yeah, all the words kind of flying about.
There's messages, not hidden messages.
There are sort of semi-hidden messages, including God, I love you. Mm. Heaven is so beautiful. Don't buy the Black Album, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Yeah.
He'll be pleased to know that I didn't because I got my mate to tape it for me again. So don't worry, Prince.
And H is for punks.
H is for punks, yes.
And he doesn't mean punks is a good thing. He doesn't think punks are cool. So his heroin, he's basically... He's using it in that kind of... Yeah, like sort of Clint Eastwood style punks. Like, go ahead, punk.
Yeah. Yeah. There's also For the Light Dance, if you don't mind... And David Stubbs cried when he heard The Ugly Duckling by Mike Reed.
On the YouTube video that I watched, always look at the comments, because I know YouTube comments are famously a kind of toxic bin fire, but you often get really interesting stuff in there. And there are comments purportedly from the people who made the video. So there's from 3 years ago and 2 years ago, respectively. PR Epstein, I'm the one that directed this cheesy video. I was supposed to supervise the edit, but time constraints and scheduling were conflicted. So Prince went on without me and cut it at some facility in LA. I remember Prince had this idea to shoot this at 6 o'clock on a Sunday evening. We filmed until 6 a.m. Monday morning. Down the road, I made a better director's...
Didn't he watch Highway? What the fuck's wrong with him?
Down the road, I made a better director's cut with better contrast. I tried to post it several times, but YouTube kept taking it down because of stupid copyright infringements. Thank you, PR Epstein. And then, after that, Peter Bate... Good day to you all. Very polite. My name is Peter and I made this video with... So I guess this is the guy who edited it. I made this video with Prince back in the late 80s. I worked at Editel, which was one of the premier edit house in the day. He had shot all the footage at his place and showed up one Monday night with a box of tapes because he knew of my effects work. Remember, this was before the computers and software of today. I had to layer each letter in the video one at a time. So, like, it might look shit, but, like, loads of work went into it.
Oh,
he said,
man.
I enjoyed a healthy working relationship with him, a nice guy, incredibly talented. I still have other versions of the video with more messages in it, but we felt we wouldn't get away with it as much as we did. I'm so glad this is available to all. Thanks. So there you go. That's Good something Lord. To dig into, isn't it?
It is. This is really interesting, right? Because I also did some reading up on the video, and what Sarah has said there corroborates a lot of what I found out. It's quite an incredible story, and it's very Prince. It's very Prince, this whole thing.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So apparently, until the last minute, despite this being the fucking lead single from his new album, he was refusing to even shoot a video, right? Just being Prince, being stubborn. Then he suddenly decided he did want to make a video on a Sunday in Minneapolis in the middle of a snowstorm, right? So he got Alan Leeds, who's one of his management team, and also the brother of Eric Leeds, who plays sax on the album, to set it up that instant. They had to shoot it that day. Just fucking now. Do me a favor. Like, snowstorm, Minneapolis on a Sunday. Eric Leeds tries telling Prince, look, you know, you're not in Los Angeles. There aren't just top quality film crews on every block, right? He wasn't taking no for an answer, so Eric Leeds just had to be seen to be making an effort. He rang absolutely everyone in the kind of broader Minnesota area who was up to the task. And a lot of them either didn't get back to him or they were snowed in or they just refused, right? So eventually Eric Leeds has to start flicking through his Rolodex for, and I don't want to sort of say this about the nice gentleman that Sarah was just quoting, but the second and third rate people. But he did find this up and coming guy who may have been one of those two, well, it must have been one of those two people, who was desperate for a break. So as for a location, the best thing they could come up with was a local cable TV station, all the effects done on blue screen. And yeah, they didn't start filming till 11 at night.
Okay, no.
The director had to add, as we've heard, all the lettering, including the message about not buying the Black Album and that anti-drugs H is for punks thing. This is after Prince had done all his prancing and writhing about. He'd gone home. He'd gone home and just left him to it.
Yeah. Off for some sex.
Yeah, probably. That's why it looks like it cost about 50 pence, even by even by 80s standards. The other thing I was going to say about it is the 1 minute and 20 seconds or whatever, 40 seconds that we get here, there's just a really heartbreaking bit in it as a fan. It's when I think the first thing we see him do, he falls into the splits and then does a reverse split without using his hands, just springs back up again.
Yes.
In fucking high heel boots. Mm. So that ultimately is what got him on the buprenorphine, the opioids, you know.
Yeah.
Oh.
So, and I get that when I see any Prince footage now. There was a gig that got shown during lockdown of one of his gigs from the Purple Rain era, and he just jumps off a high speaker stack down onto the stage without even bending his legs. And you just think, oh, fucking hell, man. No wonder he was in such pain towards the end and he got addicted to opioids. It's weird how these things become tainted with a bit of sadness.
Mm. Yeah.
The lyrics, though, right? So I'm going down to Alphabet Street. I'm going to crown the first girl that I meet, right? Mm. I mean, leaving aside the oral sex bit and what he means by crown exactly, first girl that he meets, right?
Yeah.
I know people reckon I know a lot of people say Prince had quality control issues and there's your evidence. So what, he turns the corner in his dad's Thunderbird, right? He turns the corner into Alphabet Street and he literally starts chatting up the first girl that he meets.
Oh, you know, Prince will shag out.
What if it's Bella Emberg or something? I mean,
oh, that'd be great, though.
But he's always gone on about how looks don't matter. You know, your body, your mind, you fool, and you don't have to be beautiful, etc. But you never heard about him in real life dating Hatchet Face from the John Waters movies, did you? Do you know what I mean? So I don't know if I believe him there. And also, just the whole thing of him driving around in the car, hassling women. He's not a scrub in the passenger side, but he is still driving around bothering women, and I don't know if that's cool.
Yeah, but Simon, he's going to talk so sexy, she'll want him from his head to his feet.
It's all right. It's all right, though. Like, it's not real.
It's not real.
It's not real, Pricey. It's all right. No actual women or legs were harmed in the making of this song or video.
Can I stop worrying? I can stop worrying about it.
Yeah, it's all right. Stand down. Stand down. I appreciate your allyship. Your allyship is noted and appreciated.
Well, these days you have to be performatively ally-like, don't you? I mean, it's where the money's at.
But he did describe it, I believe, as an oral cartoon, and it definitely has that kind of Tex Avery thing about it of like, I'm going to drive to Alphabet Street. I'm going to take off one of my dainty little high-heeled shoes and I'm going to theatrically bop myself in the head with it while howling. I don't know. Has anyone suggested? So, okay, so maybe it's about oral sex. Okay, that stacks up. Especially because in the long version, the recitation of the alphabet at the end misses out the G. Coincidence? Mm-hmm. Don't think so.
Why wouldn't he do the G, though?
Because he's already on the G.
It's Ingrid Chavez doing that. So maybe it's like the man with two brains and her brain's been put in a glass jar that's been it's been heated too much and they cooked her G's. They cooked her G's, man.
Why? The inhumanity.
The other theory is that Alphabet Street apparently is it's a strip of road in Minneapolis.
There it is. I was just going
to
say.
It links up 26 streets named from A to Z. But we don't know which one precisely because there are 7 streets like that in Minneapolis. It's not really about noshing, it's about roadworks.
Well, It's about, so okay, he's not actually, he's having to, you know, pull over the car a few times just because there's stuff in the way. No, but Alpha, what if it's a street of, you know, ladies of the night, and then the first girl that I meet is going to be of a certain standard? I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
What the fuck is this podcast? But do you know, like, if it's the notorious Alphabet Street where all the women come to ply their wares, then, you know, he's probably going to luck out. He doesn't have to be picky.
Why can't you just do a song called I Like Licking Fanny? Jeff Sachs would have done that. He don't give a toss.
Yeah. I mean, he probably did. I'll be honest with you.
Now, I know we don't like going off on tangents on chart music, but about 10 years ago, my mate bought an house in Nottingham off this nice old couple. And, you know, they moved in and started doing it up. And the living room was just layer upon layer of manky 70s wallpaper. So they start stripping it off and they get to the end. And on the wall, in paint, in graffiti, in massive letters, were the words, I like eating fanny, Tony. Now, Tony was the bloke in this nice old couple, and they'd only just moved up the road, got a bungalow or something, and she came round to pick up some bits and bobs, and my mate was in two minds whether to show her or not, but she did in the end, because, you know, you got to, hadn't you? And the woman looked at it, and she looked at my mate and said, oh, he must have done that in 1968 when we moved in. And then she looked back at it, and then she looked back at my mate again and said, well, he never told me. So there you go. Prince could have performed in front of that.
Yeah.
Saved himself a lot of money and a lot of effort.
I mean, subtext is a thing, you know, that apparently for all that Americans aren't supposed to be that subtle. You know, they're definitely, in this episode of Top of the Pop so far, it's, in terms of subtlety and subtext, it's America 1, Britain 0.
Yeah, but Prince had his moments of being very direct. And I expect that somewhere, maybe on the Crystal Ball or the Vault Old Friends for Sale or one of those like obscurities compilations, there is indeed I Like Licking Fanny.
So the following week, Alphabet Street dropped two places to number 11, although Love Sexy would enter the LP chart the following week at number 1. The follow-up, Glam Slam, would only get to number 29 for 2 weeks in July, and he'd have to wait a year for his next UK top 10 hit when Bat Dance got to number 2. And 4 years later, he got loads of money when Arrested Development used the word Tennessee in their single of the same name without clearing it, and his lawyers demanded and got a flat fee for $100,000.
They were quite nice about it, though. They waited until it had, like, been successful and stuff, and then, you know. And apparently he was very nice about it later, but, yeah, he still, you know, he was like, yeah, that's fine, I like the track, but also it was $100,000, so, you know.
Yeah, I mean, he could have demanded a percentage.
He was a bit like James Brown in that he didn't like hip-hop to begin with. He didn't trust it. He thought it was all just, you know, stealing talent from real musicians like him. I think he sort of changed his tune very belatedly on that. But that probably explains a little bit why he sent in the Legal Boys.
Alphabet Street, like Sesame Street, only with more letters.
And now here comes our first look at the charts. Part one.
A new entry at number 40, Heart and What About Love.
And a new entry at 39, Billy Ocean and Calypso Crazy.
Opera Hazza enters at 38 with Im Ninalu.
And new at 37, Debbie Gibson and Out of the Blue.
Also out of Reach, The Primitives this week standing at number 36.
New in at 35, Poison, Nothing But a Good Time.
Pebbles and Their Girlfriend are down to 34.
Next new entry is there at 33, Somewhere in My Heart, Aztec Camera.
Brenda Russell's Piano in the Dark this week is at 32.
And Belinda Carlisle is in at 31, Circle in the Sand. Wonderful, brilliant, mega superb, all words that have been used to describe our next band making a debut on Top of the Pops. They are fabulous. At number 23, supporting Fleetwood Mac, The Adventures, Broken Lamb, yes!
Yeah.
Maiden Mayo, now realigned, run down the chart from 40 to 31 before Mayo, flanked by two blonde women and a pig man in teal who keeps whooping for no reason whatsoever, tells us about a band who he claims has been described as wonderful, brilliant, mega, superb. As he and his minions rush off to the other side of the balcony in excitement, we discover that it's the Adventures with Broken Land. Formed in Belfast in the early 80s, the Adventures were fronted by Terry Sharp, who appeared on Top of the Pops in September of 1979 as the lead singer of Starjets, whose single War Story got to number 51 before they changed their name to Tango Brigade and split up after a flop single. After a stint as the fill-in lead singer of the Angelic Upstarts, Sharp returned to Belfast and formed the Adventures, who were signed to Chrysalis Records in 1984 and hooked up with a manager called Simon Fuller. Although they bagged a support slot on Tears for Fears' 1985 World Tour, their first four singles languished in the wrong end of the top 100, and they spent the next 2 years wriggling out of their Chrysalis deal, signing to Elektra, and working on their second LP. This is the lead cut from that LP, The Sea of Love, and is the follow-up to Two Rivers, which got to number 96 in October of 1985. It's been given a massive push by Elektra and loads of airplay. It began a slow pull up the charts in late March. It finally entered the top 40 3 weeks ago, and this week it's up 7 places from number 30 to number 23. And 2 days before they support Fleetwood Mac on the European leg of their world tour, here they are on the Top of the Pop stage at last. Well, me dears, as is the style of this era, the band picks woefully competent again, aren't they? I mean, the only thing that's leaping out to me is that picture of Poison where one of them's sticking up two fingers, but in an abusive way, like foreigners do when they attempt a peace sign and get it all wrong.
I think Debbie Gibson leapt out at me. I can't remember the song Out of the Blue, but just the existence of Debbie Gibson, and she and Tiffany were very much the kind of Taylor Swift and Miley Cyrus of their day, but they never made it to the doing interesting stuff stage that those two have done. These kind of germ-free adolescents that America was foisting on us, and they were very much sort of analogous to the Stock Aitken Waterman stars and starlets. And we've talked before about how Jonathan King forced sped up the Americanization of Britain in the late 80s. And I think it was really reaching some kind of horrific peak around this time.
Yeah, nothing really stands out to me. Like you said, it is all they've cottoned on now to the fact that you need to make the pictures good.
Yes.
I was quite struck by the beautiful hair of Pebbles.
Oh, yeah.
Filling the entire, just sort of gorgeous crimped black hair, just filling the whole frame. So I was just distracted by that and going, God, that's good hair. I mean, generally, given this is 1988, it's quite a hair-filled chart.
Yes. You
know. Primitives, lots of hair. Poison, even more hair. Heart, so much hair.
I just loved how telling the little intro and outro to the chart was about the relationship between, or the non-relationship between Mike Read and Simon Mayo, because Read goes Alphabet Street, like Sesame Street, but with more letters, which... it's exactly what I'm talking about. It's not a joke. It doesn't mean anything.
Hang on. Sesame Street use more letters. They use the full alphabet. They do G.
Good point.
Don't even try and pick it apart. And, it just doesn't. No. It don't even.
Okay, sorry.
But Mayo just blanks him and he tumbleweeds him. He fucking tumbleweeds him, which is brilliant. He just jumps in to say, let's look at the charts part one. And then when we see Mayo at the outro of it, Mike Reed's not there anymore. He's filmed below from a jaunty angle. Which I guess that might be Paul Ciani at work there. But one thing I noticed about the crowd in general, the people hanging around him, they're all these kind of hyped up gibbering idiots. They're really really overexcited. I wondered, are they all pissed? Are they all drunk? Right? Mm. And I found an interview with Anthea Turner talking about the Paul Ciani era. She says that he turned it Top of the Pops into a big party, and that the team, the production crew, the cameramen, everything, used to sort of whip everyone up, whip the audience up into this state of enthusiasm, and that there'd be a big party in the bar afterwards. And that kind of corroborates my sense of watching this episode, whether it's the women with frizzy blonde hair and bad hats, or the men who all look like spam-faced young David Camerons. they all look fucking drunk. There's this atmosphere just sort of like a pissed New Year's Eve party where people don't really care if they like the record or not. It's just like,
there was a guy earlier, actually, that I didn't pick up on the last intersection, where he was clapping, but like not just with his hands, with his like whole forearms.
like a seal.
Yeah, basically like a walrus or something, like an excited walrus. It was quite something.
So the adventures, wonderful, brilliant, mega, superb. I mean, I know absolutely fuck all about the adventures, but thankfully Simon Mayo does. He might not be the Radio 1 breakfast DJ just yet, but he's already cutting some major deals. I have in my hand a copy of yesterday's Reading Evening Post, which features his column, the unoriginally titled Simon Says. He nicked that off you, Simon.
I am going to sue.
He fills his column inches laying out the red-hot pop goss on the people of Berkshire. And the lead article in this week's column is Tickle Tackle from the Tabloids. Congratulations to Irish band The Adventures, whose Broken Land has given them their first chart hit and who seem to do equally well with the atmospheric new album Sea of Love. However, as singer Terry Sharp told me, success has also meant papers with less integrity than this one have been making up stories about him and his long-standing girlfriend, Sarah of Bananarama.
Yeah.
It doesn't bother me, so long as they print the truth, said Terry. But I did one interview and they asked me how intimidating it had been to live in the shadow of a famous girlfriend. I said it had never been a problem. I think her success is great. We get invited to the best parties. But when it appeared, it said I'd confessed to years of heartbreak about living in her shadow. The unfortunate thing is that a lot of unintelligent people believe what they read in those papers, and the gap between the truth and what is printed is astonishing. I don't mind talking to responsible papers like this, but I'll never talk to Sarah to any of the tabloids ever again. Oh, the lamestream media.
Can't believe the MSM, man. Yeah. Fake news. Yeah.
So, Terry, or, as I'm going to call him from now on, Mr. Sarah. He's got his hair gelled back and he's wearing the sort of short leather jacket that beloved of Bros around about this time, teamed with Ripped 501. So, you know, it's that look that makes him look like an extra in a bar scene in Top Gun, isn't it?
That's quite a sloppy ensemble, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah, it's very soft, the leather. It's a lovely soft,
buttery,
soft brown leather blouson. It's like chamois leather that, you know, you could buff your family saloon car with it in the driveway on a Sunday.
In fact, that's what you're supposed to do to like really bring it out.
It's a bit Lovejoy, I think. Yeah.
Well, he's not over. He is one of those frontmen who's not necessarily a natural frontman, is he? He's not overburdened with either charisma or
front.
Because this is sort of it's reaching for anthemic, this tune, and it's which I appreciate the ambition of that always when people do that, but it doesn't quite hit it, and his voice is not quite up to an anthem either. It's a bit reedy.
Mm.
I'm suddenly overcome with just self-disgust, though. I mean, sitting here going, look at them, Tom the Pops. Does this happen to you occasionally, or is it just me? You just go, God, I'm such a cunt. But
No, they're on Top of the Pops.
We never forget that they've been on Top of the Pops more than we have.
Yes.
I know this is a disclaimer, but still.
And also, they've been given the opportunity to be on Top of the Pops. So if they're not up to it, then, you know, tough shit.
Fair enough. The thing is that I thought when we were, when you were telling us about this episode, I was like, I have no idea what this is. And then when I heard it, it wasn't till the chorus kicked in that I went, oh, it's this. And
all right.
I knew it from, apparently it was the most played track on Radio 1
yes.
in 1988. So
yes. Which shows just how little of Radio 1 I was listening to at the time. Because I swear down, this is the first time I've heard this song.
Yeah, no, I definitely heard it. And I was just like, oh, okay, but there's no memory attached to it at all. Do you know what I mean? You know when you hear a thing and you go, ooh, and you get a flash of some half-remembered something in your brain, or just a feeling or a sensation. And with this, it was like, oh, it's that. And so it was just like somebody very boring in my brain went, yes, we have heard this before. I was like, oh, okay, thanks for the information. It was just completely neutral, you know. Mm. But then I realised, I was like, what does this remind me of? And I had to sing various things in my head until I hit on it. And it's Wouldn't It Be Good by Nick Kershaw.
Yes.
Yeah, big time. Big
That's
time.
What yes. this is. It's a sort of slightly kind of sleepier version of that.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, the thing about the chorus is that there's it starts in the way that I like things to start. There's a kind of loping grandiosity about it and a melancholy, which is like, oh, this is all up my street. There's a slightly talky sort of thing with the strident piano, which is nice. It's really nice. And then the chorus kicks in and it's like, oh, there's the Irish whistle that aligns with the vocal line. I just thought it just feels unnecessary. I mean, it's like, of course you want to align yourself with the proud tradition and you want to reference it, but it's just kind of not adding anything here. It's like,
no, it does go a bit Irishy at the end, doesn't it?
Yeah.
To start off, I've got to say that the drummer, Paul Crowder, messaged me on Twitter earlier this year about something or other.
You're not going to slag my band off, are you?
He makes music documentaries.
Ah.
So I just want to say that the drumming on this track is wonderful, brilliant, mega, superb. Because, he's... Oh, by the way, he was also the engineer on Last Christmas by Wham and Careless Whisper.
Was he now?
Last Christmas by Wham and Careless Whisper by George Michael. And on on Susie's Nocturne live album. And in terms of films, he's won awards for films about skateboarding. This is one called Dogtown and Z-Boys. Or Z-Boys.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he co-directed the film about the American football team, New York Cosmos, Once in a Lifetime.
Fuck!
Yeah. So he's, he's a significant filmmaker. So I just want to praise his drumming.
Yeah.
What amazing careers people have. This is the thing is, once you start doing, and this is going to come up again later as well, is like these 3 minutes that you see of someone on Top of the Pops might be the height of what they've done, or it might be nothing compared to what they went on to do,
Exactly. But we've heard a bit about the singer Terry's past before this moment, and he was already 33, so it's kind of last chance saloon for him. And you look at the rest of the band, and they all look fairly old as well. They all look like knocking on a bit. I actually watched the clip of Terry Sharp in his previous band, the Star Jets, on Top of the Pops, and I've got to say, to some people, it might look like very tinny amateur punk, but it dawned on me that if somebody put it to me that it sounds a bit like the early Manic Street Preachers, I couldn't really deny it, because it kind of does.
No, I like War Stories. I was shocked when I was doing the notes for this and found out that it wasn't a top 40 hit. Because I remember that song very well. I loved it at the time.
First time I've heard it, I've got to be honest. And then I guess he had his moment making a cameo in the Bananarama video for Shy Boy.
Right. He was the Shy Boy, was he?
Yeah. He's in that video. So, you do get the sense that this is his last big shot or their last big shot at it. It only reached number 20, but it feels like a bigger hit. And Sarah mentioned that it was the most played song on Radio 1 in 88. You said, Al, that you can't remember it. I can. This is my thought. It's like, all right, well, it wasn't a big chart hit, but the reason it's stuck in my head, because it really is stuck in my head, is that it was on the radio all the fucking time. It really was. Radio 1 really wanted that to be bigger than it was. The verses of the song, as Sarah pointed out, are quite talkish with the piano, quite white pyjama, I would say. If anyone doesn't know what white pyjama music is, where can they find out, Al?
You can go to the Chart Music A to Z, our Wicca.
Yes.
Yeah. Or you can just collar Simon in a pub. After you've shouted bummer dog at him, ask him to explain to you about white pyjama music.
After you've crossed his palm with bummer dog.
So it starts off in that quite kind of downbeat way, but the chorus spoils it or improves it, depending on your taste by going all epic. Mm. You know, it's one of those kind of standing on a clifftop, gazing meaningfully into the oncoming wind with, you know, your mullet flapping in the breeze. He spoils it by not having a mullet, actually. This band, they sound like they got mullets. They haven't, but they ought to. But somehow they don't quite have the conviction of their own mega epicness because, you know, when it comes to the bit in the shadow of this truly dying world, something catches his eye in the Top of the Pops audience and he does a cheesy grin.
Yeah.
And it just seems to kind of go against the sort of tone of what he's trying to say in the song. But the chorus, it is very similar to the Nick Kershaw song, Wouldn't It Be Good? But it is massive. It's an impossible to argue with chorus. You're just like, oh, okay, I'm going to just sit here while you do your thing, chorus, because you are huge. It's, you know, a very big chorus. A weird thing to still be happening in the late 80s, this kind of music, or then again, maybe not, because there was a lot of what I call record company rock knocking around at this time. So it was bands like Diesel Park West, River City People, Goodbye Mr. Mackenzie, lots of three-word names. And then also people like Hurrah, the Milltown Brothers, then Jericho, who actually broke big for 5 minutes, Danny Wilson, who are actually in this top 40, finally, after the third reissue. But this sort of airbrushed, stonewashed pop rock that record companies really spent a lot of money on and really thought could break big, and usually it didn't. The song, the Wikipedia entry for it says the song references their experiences of the Troubles, with a capital T. Well, yeah, it does, but it's not exactly Suspect Device, is it? It's not even Sunday Bloody Sunday. Right? No. It goes, these rivers run too deep with schemes of men for days that lay ahead. They sell their souls so cheap, they breed mistrust and fill my heart with dread. Yeah. So it's not.
Why
very
don't they just make
about
some love on Wasteland for fuck's sake?
Exactly, right? I guess they're trying to appeal to all communities and make a plea for unity through the barricades, as you say. But even if you didn't know that one of them was called Gerard Spud Murphy, you could probably figure out the community that they're coming from. I mean, it's got the tin whistle and the fiddle, and you don't have to be a genius to sort of kind of decode that. And indeed, Terry Sharp went to St. Malachy's College, which is a big Catholic school in Belfast. Eamon Holmes went there, and Martin O'Neill. That's where he's coming from.
Sorry, this is some really granular stuff. I have to take my hat off to you for the depth of your research here. This is amazing.
Oh, man, I'm fucking pro here. Yeah. they were managed by Simon Fuller, who later invented the Spice Girls and S Club. And Simon Fuller, right, was certified by Billboard as being the most successful British music manager of all time. And that's including people like Brian Epstein and Andrew Lou Goldham. Mm. So I read an interview, and again, deep research here, with Terry Sharp from The Adventures, where he says, I think he made all his mistakes with us.
Yes.
So he's laughing about it now. I find it kind of hard to hate this song. It's very not me. It was very much against everything that I was into at the time. There's something a bit upsetting about how the guy, when he sings Open Up Your Arms, it's actually Open Up Your Arms, it's Open. I never liked that kind of thing. But it's kind of, as I say, it's this kind of steamroller of a big chorus that's impossible to argue with. I don't think they necessarily had much else in the locker. In the dying seconds of this performance, I don't know if you noticed, but he crouches down and frantically waves at something in the distance, and I would say it's the Adventures' chart career leaving them.
Yeah, taxi for the Adventures. No wonder he's fucking put off, though, Simon, because, you know, Top of the Pops are rolling out their new innovation. The camera crew, they've got handheld cameras now, which means they can really get involved on stage. And it gives us, as the audience, the opportunity to see the keyboard player cupping his bollocks as he plays with his free hand.
I didn't see that.
Yes.
Oh, and another thing I thought was kind of sweet about this is that there's a female member of the band, Eileen Gribben, I think her name is. Mm. She plays the viola and backing singer. On this record, she doesn't appear to do anything. She doesn't really appear to do any backing singing. But they're obviously like, well, look, you're in the band. Yeah. We're on Top of the Pops. You're fucking coming with us.
Yes.
So she just sort of stands there and sort of boogies a little bit.
Yeah, you can't bez just yet, can you?
You just bring your knitting in that, and you know.
Yeah.
That'd be really good if someone just sat there and knitted a scarf.
Yeah. The only other note I've got for this song is stop fucking whooping, stupid audience.
But they're all pissed.
Yeah.
They're all smashed out their minds on Malibu and Pineapple.
Yeah.
God, yeah, this is such a Malibu and Pineapple situation, this entire era of Top of the Pops, isn't it?
So the following week, Broken Land slipped up three places to number 20, but got no further. The follow-up, Drowning in the Sea of Love, would only get to number 44 in July of this year, and they never got to suckle at the teat of the top 40 ever again. After taking a folkier direction, their next LP, Trading Secrets with the Moon, flopped in early 1990, and they were dropped by Elektra. And after being picked up by Polydor, they put out two more LPs, which also failed to chart, and they split up in 1993. All right, M-Pop Great Jumpsters, I do believe it is time to step back from this episode and catch a bit of a breather. So come and join us tomorrow for more 1988-related larks and jollities. On behalf of Sarah B and Simon Price, my name's Al Needham. Go easy. Step light, Lee. Stay pop crazed.
Chart music.
GreatBigOwl.com.
Heavy Pencil.
An actor of my experience, you just get wrung dry.
A podcast sitcom
with Anna Crilly
and Tony Gardner.
I played Edmund Gelder, and he played Fanny Snatch.
The Observer called it
a lovely thing. Wonderfully funny, pitched perfectly, produced with a light touch.
I'm not having any more of this. I need you to pull me off immediately.
Heavy Pencil from Great Big Owl.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.